This man needs no introduction. He's done wonderful things for our activity. And believe me, without him, I wouldn't be dancing C4 or calling it or anything else. Bill Hyman.
Thank you, Sandy. It's very nice. I remember back in, about 83, we had a C3 workshop for a year, and Sandy was in it, and the rest is history. So, that's right. Just a couple things I want to say at the beginning. I'm going to speak about dancer-run workshops. I don't know about caller-run workshops, and I should be the last person on earth to stand up here and tell you how to run a caller-run workshop. So, and the other thing is, when we started our workshopping in Chicago about 30 years ago, we did some things that were different at the time, and I don't know how much they've been incorporated around the country. But what I'm going to talk about is what I believe has worked for us. That doesn't mean it's the only way to do anything. It just means this is what I'm familiar with, and they asked me to talk about it, so I'm going to do that. But I am not in any way suggesting that we know the right answer to everything. We don't. Okay? Just a little bit on my background. I started dancing in the fall of 75. That's 1975, Lee. And I've been a C4 dancer for several years, still trying it. My wife and I attend about 115 dances a year. That's live dances. That's not counting workshops. And I can't stress enough the value of live dancing. I think, for example, I think something like this convention, coming here, is worth a year's worth of workshops. When you can get this much concentration on something, it's invaluable. That's my opinion, anyway. We have a C4 group in Chicago that meets on Tuesday night, and it's been going since April of 77. Not all the same people are in it, but some of them are. I've also led other workshops over the years. I love to talk about workshops. It's just a fascinating thing to me, how we get together and how we can try to improve ourselves, and I love that. Some of the unique aspects that we do in our workshop, and I say unique because I think a lot of them that we started doing it this way, and again, I don't know how unique it is anymore, but some of the things that we do and don't do that might be helpful. Our workshop lasts 2.5 hours. One of the things we try to do is simulate a dance in our workshop. Dances generally last about 2.5 hours, so workshops go 2.5 hours. I have workshopped in Florida several times, and they have a 3-hour workshop. And it's amazing to me how I find myself just going like this, and I look at the clock, and there it is, 2.5 hours. So you get used to something, I think. I'm gonna have to put these on. Sorry, guys. Another thing that I just feel that we've got 10 people in a workshop. You get together, you're taking 10 times 2.5 hours of man hours time to do this. So it's important to be as efficient as you can in workshop. Another thing that I try to do is, if I can tell there are nights when the whole group, the attention span starts to wane at about 2 hours or whatever it is. We just had a full weekend, people are tired, quit early. It's just not it's counterproductive to just keep going when everybody's dead tired. We take generally one, maybe two breaks a night. They tend to get a little longer than I'd like at this point, mainly because my wife is in charge of when the break starts and when it ends, and she's real good at when it starts. Well, we do. We started this right at the beginning, and it's worked pretty well. The idea is to try to start on time. So one of the ways we did to encourage that is we have a sheet of paper out on the table as you walk in, and you sign your name like you're signing in. And then the last one in is the first one out. And we just go up the ladder. So the first guy here is the last one to sit out. And that's worked pretty well for us. We don't use there's some mixing charts that I've seen in other workshops where you come in at, I don't know, does it go 1, 2, 4, 3 and out or something like that. We don't use them. I'm not criticizing them. They might work fine. Our system has worked for us, so we just keep using it. We don't worry in workshop about who's opposite who. We just square up and we go. I know, I think that sometimes I've heard from people tell me that somebody always has to square up opposite this person or that person. I have two thoughts on it. I don't think that's helping a person very much. But if there is, at some level, it might be helping the workshop. So I don't know. I'm a little ambiguous on the subject. We have a calendar that we put out at workshop right next to the sheet of paper. And if you know you're not going to be at workshop on July 24th, you just look for that box and say, no Bruce, no Carol, whatever it is. And so we know in advance who's going to be here and who's not. When we dance, we do not shortcut anything. I believe that what you want to do is form the habits of doing everything correctly. And then you're ready when the guy puts a roll or he does something else with it, a quarter more or something like that. So when we workshop, we do everything, every call, exactly how it's written. We do Alaman lefts, we do right and left grands, we do courtesy turns, all that type of thing. We try to simulate a dance. And I like to practice those things I'm going to do later so I don't have to think about them. One of the exceptions that we had to make, the only exception I'm aware of that we do that somebody could call cheating, we have a fellow in our workshop that edited the tapes, and it was really wonderful. He took out all the gaps between sequences. If the caller was standing trying to help a square, took that out. The idea is we could just dance, and it was wonderful, and I've really gotten used to it, and it's great. But the only problem he had was he never knew how much time to allow on a promenade. So sometimes he would cut the thing short and we wouldn't be home and the caller's starting the next sequence. So what we decided to do about this was we always promenade in the correct direction and we go to the nearest head or side position. Meaning this, if I start out as the number two couple, when we promenade, if I hit four first, I just stop there. You understand what I mean? So if you started out ahead, you're always ahead. Start out a side, you're always a side, but you may rotate around. And the only reason we did that was because of the editing of the tapes. So I think if that's the only thing we do that you could call cheating, that's pretty good, I think. I've been in workshops where they don't promenade, they don't right and left grand. I mean, that's their choice, but we don't do that. We love to right and left grand. I look at that, that's our reward for getting the sequence. It's fun. You go around, you smile, you whatever. We think that that's important. If we repeat a sequence, we write a left grand. If we walk a sequence, we write a left grand. So, anyway, that's what we do. One of the things that I found in some workshops that I think is one of the most counterproductive things you can do, and what I try to stress is, don't ever explain why you made a mistake. We've all made it. We'll all probably make it again. It's just counterproductive. You made a mistake, go on. Learn from it, learn what happened, but don't explain why you did it wrong. That's my opinion. We try to maintain a high energy level. I think the right and left grands have something to do with that, but we're here, we're supposed to have fun, so have fun. I assign responsibility for various tasks. Like I said, my wife is in charge of breaks, sort of. Somebody else is in charge of this sheet and the telling who's out and that sort of thing and whatever. My wife likes to cater the event. That's something we don't agree on. But I frankly don't think that food is necessary at a workshop. My wife believes that it has to be catered and that there's a buffet out there. So something we don't agree on. I will often have just short meetings with the group. And it'll be during a break. I'm kind of famous for having like 20-second meetings. And the reason I do that is that so everybody has a chance of input and everybody, when the meeting's over, knows the same thing. It isn't that I told Jerry and he told this guy and then somebody else hears it. Just to give you an example, we had a situation come up, I'm going to say maybe 15 years ago, and we started to get tapes from Japan with the Japanese callers. Now, some of them have become pretty darn good callers, but the problem's the language. And so we found we were stopping the tape so often just because we couldn't figure out what he said. Now, is that productive? Is that a productive use of our time when there's a lot of other tapes we could use? And there were grumblings, or people had different points of view, so we got together, we talked it out, and I believe we came at a compromise is, yes, let's do them, but let's limit it to maybe 30 minutes a workshop. So that's the kind of thing that I think the whole workshop should be involved in and make a decision. One of the key things that we started with this workshop was the idea of keeping the tape running. again, I believe in practicing dancing, not practicing stopping. So the idea is that somebody's in charge of the tape recorder. In our workshop, that's generally me, for better or worse. And the idea is that I try to keep the tape going, even if somebody makes a mistake, a couple people make a mistake. If the square's going, we're at a dance. You can't stop the caller. So you've got to learn what to do in a square when you don't know what to do. I call it square survival skills. And some people are better at that than others. And why not practice that in a workshop also? Now, of course, if the whole square is broken down, there is no point in keeping the tape going. I'll stop it and rewind it and we'll start over. But the idea is keep the tape going. On the promenade, if anybody wants to look at something, didn't understand something, they get my attention. When we get home, I stop the tape, and then we'll go back and look at it. We can spend 5 seconds on it. We can spend 5 minutes. We can spend 20 minutes. It doesn't matter. But we've combined the idea of dancing without stopping with being able to ask questions. And it's worked very well for us. We've had new people come into the workshop at times, and they say to me, I don't think I can learn that way. And I say, give it 3 or 4 months, and then come and talk to me. Give it a chance. It's worked before. I've never had anybody come back to me. And another thing is, I try to stress in there, anybody can ask a question or stop the tape on a promenade for whatever they want, as many times as they want, and nobody is to ever make fun of them or snicker or whatever. That's what we're there for. I've never really had anybody abuse it, and I think it's a very good learning experience. What I'll do generally is if they say, I didn't understand such and such, we'll get all the dancers back to that position. And then I try to say the call without anybody moving, so the person has a chance to think about what it was. Because I believe that nobody can teach you better than you can. So if we go back and you see the setup and you hear the call again, often that person will teach themselves what's wrong. And so that's what I try to do. Sometimes people will say, well but that's not going to work because I won't remember what it was that I didn't see. I said, don't worry about it. A, somebody next to you probably will. Somebody saw the situation. Somebody saw a trouble spot, a potential one, they'll say it. And if nobody can remember, we rewind the tape and we do the sequence over and we stop at that point. You follow me? And to me, that combines the best of continuing to dance, but still having the ability to look at things. There are other times where we'll go back and somebody was really having a problem with that call, for example. Well, I'll just sight through that call several times just to get it. I'm very fortunate. I have two of the best callers on earth in the workshop, Sandy and many of you probably know Lynette Bellini. Just have them walk the thing. Now, everybody doesn't have that ability. I understand that. But keep in mind when you're in a workshop, if you have to walk some people through something, you don't have to be elegant and wonderful and have the ability to stand up here and call to a C1 floor at the convention. Just do it. If they're having a problem with chain reaction, for example, well, you know that starts in a quarter tag position. Get them into a quarter tag, do chain reaction. Get them into another one and do another chain reaction. And just keep doing it. It doesn't have to be elegant, and you don't have to resolve it. When you think that the message is gotten, square up. That's fine. Okay. I've also, over the years, written a lot of practice sequences for the workshop. A lot of them are on various concepts that people will have trouble with. If something's new, then we can have something that we can work. And I think a lot of you people say, well, I don't know that I could do that. Remember, you don't have to write the world's greatest sequence. You have to write something that you can practice, and it's helping the people. And you don't have to resolve it. Although with SD these days, that becomes pretty easy. But don't worry about that. Nobody's ever going to see them. They're not going to appear on a tape anywhere. Just do it. Okay. We have, and I would strongly recommend this, a designated leader. There's one person that talks. There's one person that decides when the tape's going to stop. There's one person that's not necessarily going to answer the question, but the question's directed to. Many, many times, I have some very talented square dancers in this workshop. I'm very happy to have them. And I'll just say, Sandy, can you explain this one? Kevin, can you explain this one? You know, and so on. The leader does not have to be the person that knows everything. I don't think the world's created that person yet, but anyway, people worry about that. What you want in a leader is a guy that's a person that's a leader, can take charge, that people respect. And if somebody has a question, maybe he may be the worst choreographer in the group, but he can take charge and he can say, "Would you, as somebody, answer that or whatever." But to have these things where I've seen this in workshops where something happens and then everybody starts talking and you have these two arguing over here and these three discussing over here, counterproductive again. That's the main thing to keep in mind. What's productive? We, all of our dancers all through the years have actively attended dances. You've got to do that. I don't know that I would want someone in workshop who just goes to a workshop, because it's not enough. You've got to get out live, and traveling around the country is valuable too for it to become a good dancer. You've got to know how to dance with a lot of people. People that are slow, people that are fast, people that make mistakes, people that don't make mistakes. Don't be intimidated by those people that all of a sudden appear better than you are. This is part of the game. You've got to go out. And as I said before, coming to something like this with so much concentrated dancing, wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. And lastly, I think one of the things that helps us, and you can never underestimate this, talent. Having people in there that have the ability to do this. And I remember several years ago, my friend Paul Gelbert and I were searching the internet for various square dancing sites for a project we were doing. And there's so many of them that said, everybody can square dance. Well, that's baloney. And we all know that. I don't know what talent it is that various people have that makes them better dancers. I have no idea what it is, but it's clear they are. And not everybody that's a plus dancer can be a C2 dancer. That's okay. The best part of this activity, in my opinion, is that we have this big range of a spectrum here. And that anybody can participate, not anybody, but most people can participate at their interest level, at their ability, and whatever. And because you dance C3 and somebody else dances A2, that doesn't make you a better dancer than the other. I mean, it doesn't make you a better person than the other person. It doesn't necessarily mean you're a better dancer either, frankly, but that's another story. Okay, I want to just talk about some of the potential problems that I've seen in other workshops or heard people talk about. Sometimes I've heard that they use inferior equipment and the cassette player is always breaking down or everything. We've gotten to the point now with Keith and his equipment and various other things that shouldn't be a problem. And if you have to buy a new MD player or a PC or something like that, chip in, buy the thing, and again, efficient use of your time. We tried, I think a lot of times I've seen people, the groups that are casual about their start times. We try to start on time, end on time. I think you establish that precedent. People know that's what's going to happen. When we have eight people there, we start. We try to start at 7:30, but if somebody's late, as soon as the eighth person comes, you start. Another problem that I've heard so many people say, this workshop's been going so long and this group, this couple isn't keeping up, and what do we do? If I have done this, if I've started a different workshop, I always will say, this workshop will start on September 14th and it will end on June 10th. Always have a starting and a stopping time of a workshop. Reform it if you need to. Get a different composition of people if you need to, but everybody knows it's going to stop there and that they're not necessarily going to be involved if you have another one. And I strongly recommend doing that. It is a way you could deal with it. I think, to me, that's the best way I've ever heard of dealing with this problem. It's not a perfect solution by any means. And this problem has been talked about as long as there's been square dancing, and it's a problem. Nobody has the magic bullet that I've heard of anyway. But this way, I think you might be able to ease into it better. I think a lot of groups that I've heard of and seen, to my opinion, dance tapes that are too hard. If you're stopping the tape every third or fourth call, something's wrong. That's not good. Now, there's a couple ways that I've had of dealing with this. One is, if we're doing that, we'll dance about, let's say, four sequences. Then we'll stir the bucket. I'll rewind those four sequences and go back and say, all right, now we're just going to dance these. We've done them. We've stopped. We've looked at things. We should be able to dance this. And then dance through. I'll just put my remote down on the table, and we'll just dance. And the tape's not going to stop like at a dance. That's one way that I think has worked, has helped. Another thing is maybe you need to do a lower level tape or an easier tape for part of the workshop. Start out with an easier one or something. Another thing I notice, we have nights where just the group is not there for whatever reason. It happens. And it amazes me. I can see one or two people having a bad night. It amazes me when a whole group does. But it happens. All right? Don't kill them. Put on an easier tape. I mean, we're here to enjoy and whatever. Life's too short. So those are just a couple of things that you might want to think about if you have this problem. But again, if you're stopping the tape every third, fourth call, I've heard groups like this, something's wrong and you need to change something. That's my opinion anyway. I've talked to you about how we stop the tape. Another thing that some groups have, they'll have the person that sits out run the tape. And then that person stops it when the square breaks down and whatever. I realize we have all these, especially key system with the remote. I strongly recommend that you use that. But the thing that I find with that system is that everybody has a different idea of exactly when the tape should stop. And I've heard people say, well, she stops it whenever she doesn't see something, you know, or something like that. So having one person in charge of deciding when the tape stops, I think is a good idea. You get some consistency at least. Hopefully that person does a good job of it, but I think it's better to do that. I've been in places where we had equipment that somebody sitting out had to run it. And so what I would do is I'd say, watch me, and I'll tell you when to stop the tape. But again, I think it's better if there's some consistency and one person does it. And again, he does not have to be the best dancer. That's crazy. It has to be somebody that can take charge. That's what you need. All right, now just a couple of miscellaneous items here. I've been asked over the years about teach tapes. Frankly, I don't know anything about them. I've never used them. I'm not being critical of them at all, but I don't have any recommendations. We just have never had occasion to use them. There's also this system of marks on the floor, tape spots on the floor. You're familiar with that at all? Anybody? I strongly recommend doing that. I think we many years ago when this idea came out, I think it was a guy in our workshop actually that came up with it, and we put tape spots on the floor. We made a 16 matrix every 27 inches. Was it? I mean, we tried various things. And we made a 4x4 matrix and putting the spots. What it does is provide you discipline in your dancing so that you don't have these huge squares. I think a lot of times dancers, the biggest mistake they make in terms of this kind of thing is they're too far apart laterally. You know, when you're holding hands with somebody like this, you're too far apart, I think. And when you have these tape spots, it provides the discipline. And it's interesting, after a couple of years, we just took them up because we didn't need them anymore. We all just had a sense, I think a 27-inch sense about it. So I would recommend doing that with the group. I want to talk a little bit about studying calls, which at least is related to workshopping. I've done an awful lot of this over the years, and I should get back to doing more of it at the moment, but I don't think that workshop is necessarily the place to learn the definition of a call. That's something you should do on your own, I think. I strongly recommend dancing by definition. There's a lot of great books out. Get them. Study them. Now, one of the things that I did when I was studying a lot was I would try to multitask, and I would practice my calling when I was doing something else. I'd put a note up on the mirror, and while I was shaving, I would go through these. And I would say, and as I was dancing, I'd look for things that I was a little weak on, I wasn't sure of, I'd add them to the list. Just go over them and over. When you study a call, be sure that you verbalize the definition. Don't just say, well, I go over here and I do this and, you know, whatever. That's not good enough. That's going to kill you at some point. If you're going to go up and challenge dancing, you've got to know the definition. You've got to have it cold. Another thing to do, when you're studying a definition, the most important thing to get down cold is the first thing you do, because you're buying thinking time. So concentrate on that. What's the first movement I make from anywhere I am on the floor? Very important. I believe that the best time to study a call is when you're dancing at a lower level than you dance. I think some people go there and they just kind of flit around. And I'll give you an example. Is parallelogram C2? Is that right? C2. And at C2, I don't know how many, I don't know the level, you guys, and I hope I'm not talking over somebody's head. I don't intend to. But with parallelograms, the hardest part about parallelograms is when you have a call that changes shape. So you kind of have to get an algorithm in your head about how you're going to put this thing back when you finish it. So what I did, at C2, you're not going to get much of that. And you get up to the higher levels, you get a lot of it. So what I did is when I went to a C2 dance, I always practiced my algorithm. Even though I didn't need it, probably wouldn't need it at that dance, because they probably aren't going to change shape. So that's the idea. When you go to if you're a C2 dancer and you go to an A2 dance, practice those A2 definitions while you're dancing. I mean, gosh, you're taking up the time. You're on the floor. Why not make productive use of your time? It worked for me, I think. I also have written a paper that's on the web if you're interested. But I call it mental image practicing. And what I did is I have three columns. And I write down and I'll say, I'm the lead end of a right-hand wave. The second column is I'll give the call. And then my objective, I hold my hand over the third column, is to say, how does this call end for everybody? Does it end in lines? Does it end in columns, diamonds, whatever it is? And where am I in that setup? Now, just as an example, if I said I'm the lead end of a right-hand wave, the call is flip back. I think I end up as a trailing center of waves. That's the idea. And you can write your own. You can pattern them after the level that you're on. And it's a good review sheet for me as I go to weekends, when I go to dances. I look over this thing. I think it's good discipline. The two things you want to know is, how does my overall setup change shape, and where am I in it? Those are the two things you want to concentrate on, from my point of view. That's what I've tried to do. On Lynette's website, lynette.org, if you want to write that down, my paper is on there. Now, I will tell you, this is geared to C4. If you don't dance that level, you might want to look at it just to get the idea of what I've done. But there's no reason you can't do that at any level. And I think it does provide good discipline, and I think it's helped me. Keep in mind, some of the things I've got on that sheet are not a walk in the park. So if you're having a little trouble with it, don't worry about it. It was set up that way. I wanted to push myself. And also, another thing that I think people forget about is the SD program. And of course, you know it's free. You can download it anytime you want. And I've used it as a study guide. From this setup, I'll have the heads pair off and step to a wave. And then I'll say, there's a feature on it where you can say pick call. So if you signed in at the C1 level, you'll never get a call that's higher than C1. And when you hit pick call, it goes in and selects some random call. And it shows the dancers before the call, and it shows them after the call. So what I'll do is I'll go in and I'll look at the before picture, and I'll say, I'm the lead center, whatever it is. I'm number two man. And then I'll say, pick random call, and it'll come back with some call. And before I look at the ending setup, I'll say, all right, what does this do to the overall setup, and where am I in it? And then I'll look to see if I was right. And then I'll just undo that, which takes that out, and I'll say, pick another one. And just keep doing that. If you're having trouble with a concept, you can go in, let's say it's parallelogram. You can go in on the thing and get people in waves. You have to get them into a parallelogram somehow. And then you can just go in and you can say, parallelogram, pick call. and it'll pick a parallelogram flip back, maybe something like that. Again, find out where you are in your mind, decide how to do this, or move the checkers if you want to do that, and then look up and see if you're right. It's instant feedback. So I would suggest using it. And again, the program is free. I know you can go to Lynette.org again, and that's one of the links that she has on there. And just a couple things in closing. One of the things this is something I've tried to do all the years I've been dancing, is I try to be the kind of dancer in the square that I want to dance with. And I think that's probably a good way to look at it. If you're in there grouchy, do you want to dance with grouchy dancers? Do you, dance with somebody who's fooling around, who's not concentrating? I don't think so. So I try to be that type of person that I want to dance with. Again, I stress the trying to look for the efficient use of your time in a workshop. And I always say, if we spend 10 minutes doing this and there's 10 people there, that's 100 minutes. Is that the best way to use those 100 minutes? And I always try to form habits of doing every little thing correctly. It amazes me about this activity, of the times we make mistakes, it's always these things. It's not this great big call, it's these things. I wrote a paper one time and I talked about the difference between a shortstop on a baseball, I'm a baseball fan, who can make these spectacular plays but blows the routine ones. Who wants him? The reason is, in baseball, you'll get 100 routine balls for every one spectacular opportunity. People say, but I'm worried that he's going to call this great big long hard call. I said, look, the key is get to the call. Do the little things right so that you get to the position where you have a chance to do this hard thing. That's the key. So I would stress that. So anyway, I try to form habits of doing all these little things correctly. Cast three quarters, one of the hardest calls in the world. It's blown a lot because we don't pay attention. We know how to do it, but we have to pay attention. So anyway, that's about all I have to say, folks. Anybody has any questions, I'll be glad to ask them, or answer them, excuse me. Yes, sir. We meet once a week. I think most workshops around the country meet once a week. I also am involved in what I call a workshop weekend, that we meet about 5-6 times a year for a complete weekend and get together. That's another way you could handle it, especially if there's driving distances involved. You might want to look at it that way. Maybe once a month have a weekend. But most workshops are weekly. Yes, sir. Good question. I think the ideal number is about, we don't think in terms of couples, we think in terms of people. But you can divide by two, clearly. I think 10 is a very good number. I think 11 is okay, where you can afford this. I think 12, you're getting to too many people. That's just my opinion and from what I've seen around the country. An interesting situation developed in Florida a few years ago that I thought they had a very unique way of dealing with it. They down there have a problem because there are a few of them that live there all year long, and there's a lot of them that come down for, I don't know, January, February, and March maybe, snowbirds. And so people want to get in workshops. Well, this one group got to the point where they had 14 people in the workshop. Now, that's a lot of sit-outs. So what they did was they designated maybe one couple each week that would not come to the workshop. And they just rotated. And this week, it's your week. That's another way you could handle it if you have a lot. I thought that's a clever idea. I admired that. But I think 10, 11 is about the ideal number, is my thought. Anyone else? Well, thank you, guys. Thanks for coming out. Getting up early.